I've started to realise over the last decade or so that often the poets that read for less time are better poets. It seems to be true. I was thinking of Steve mentioning time, the strange business of time. I've been reading St. Augustine, and I've written about some poems about that, which I'll read. He says he didn't believe in time. He said, "Dear Lord, forgive me for saying this, but I don't think there is such a thing. I think it's a mere extension of our mind." I like that. And I'll read a poem that's based on reading his autobiography, his Confessions. The Confessions after St. Augustine. "When my first love, Una, was torn from my side, it crushed my heart. We sent her back to Africa, an obstacle to marriage and advancement in Rome. When she left, my diseased soul fluttered above my mother's glowing head. Months passed, news arrived. Una vowed she'd never love another man. Our son lived with me inside the gates, grew up without the sanction of wedlock. Una lived alone and drank wild honey in attempts to ease the pain. There'd be no healing. Absence remained a wound. Although a slave to lust, I took a mistress. Through long days and streaky nights, my raw side festered. Meanwhile, I was sinning more and more, fully aware, no matter what, there'd be no cure." When I was commissioned to write my autobiography, I started reading The Confessions because I figured out it was probably one of the first autobiographies. There's a couple of others, but that was the one that I chose as a model. The poem I just read is almost word for word from his Confessions, from a plain English translation done by a fellow in Oxford. And it's just such clear prose. And I've been thinking about what is a soul? And I'm reading back through history where people were weighing up souls and all that sort of thing. And I came across a quote from C.S. Lewis. I think he was in Oxford too when he wrote, we don't have a soul, we are a soul, we are a body. And that came to mean a bit more to my search for the soul. So the next few poems are about that, and identity and language. The first one is "Listening to Cuckoos." We have a bird, I don't know whether it comes to America, but it's called a coel. It's got, cuckoos have this sound around the world, two notes. "Listening to cuckoos, two unchanging notes, to us, words, always those high, elongated notes. Red-eyed coels with feathered earmuffs, downward-ending notes that pour through a falling of night, coming over the distances. Words that don't change. The two notes remain, a split phrase, two words, meaning not exactly a self, not quite the first day of spring. The moment of utterance, candor becomes the piercing whistled syllables, penetrating the dark green of twilight. The storm birds call, two notes, two words, and cackle in the broken-egged dawn, in the echoing light." That's after they've eaten the eggs of their of local birds' nest and laid their own. This is a poem I wrote for my wife Juno, and it's set in our garden, which is right on the river, on the Hawkesbury River outside of Sydney. Garden poem. "Sunlight scatters wild bees across a blanket of flowering lavender. The garden grows visibly in one morning. native grasses push up, tough and lovely as your angels' trumpets. At midday, the weather, with bushfire breath, walks about talking to itself. A paper wasp zooms above smooth river pebbles. In the trees, possums lie flat on leafy branches to cool off. The cats notice, then fall back to sleep. This day has taken our lives to arrive. Afternoon swings open, although the mechanics of the sun require the moon's white oil. Daylight fades to twilight, streaking bottle brush flowers with shade. A breeze clatters in the green bamboo and shakes its lank hair. At dinner time, the French doors present us with a slice of night, shining clear. A Naples yellow moon outlines the ridges of the mountains. All this neatly laid out on the dining room table across patches of moonlight. And then there's, I'll get back to that. I'll just read a poem to broaden out what I'll do next. This is a poem about my grandfather was a professional fisherman, and those are implements, a net needle and a bobbin. He carved from local cedar. He carved this one himself. He left me those with his fishing nets, and they'd be about 80, 90 years old. And Juno took this photo. So fishing comes into my poetry. It's something I did when I was young, and I worked. It was my job for a long time. I took it for granted what it was. It wasn't sort of coming into the poetry world. I realized people would gasp in horror when I told them I caught an 80-pound mulloway. They go, "What do you mean? I caught it and killed it," and things like that. So I wrote this poem, turning fishing into poetry, I guess. The Gathering Light. It is based on an actual event. The Gathering Light. Morning shines on the cowling of the Yamaha, locked to the stern of the boat. Spears of light shoot away from the gunmetal grey enamel. Now I wait for God to show, instead of calling him a liar. I've just killed a mulloway. It's 85 pounds, 20 years old. The huge mauve-silver body trembles in the hull. Time whistles around us, an invisible flood tide that I let go while I take in what I have done. It wasn't a fight. I was drawn to this moment. The physical world drains away into a golden calm. The sun is a hole in the sky, a porthole. You can see turbulence out there, the old wheeling colours and their dark forces. But here, on the surface of the river, where I cradle the great fish in my arms and smell its pungent death, a peace I've never known before, a luminous absence of time, pain, sex, thought, of everything but the light. So then here's a poem about some of the people in the fishing culture of the town called Brooklyn on the Hawkesbury River. John Ashbery came up to see us there. We took him to the local pub, and he said, "This is Brooklyn." He really liked it. He said, "This is the real Brooklyn." swimming at this is a yeah. This is the people that live around the shore, swimming out with Emmylou Harris. A long curved horizon, the hazel-coloured tide, and Lion Island going by. A CD player skips on the line. A quarter moon in a 10-cent town. On the swell, our wake shatters the reflection of the real moon. We cut through the sound of swimming, the meaningless joy of living, the random punishment of birth. The song says we all live up to what we get. Out here you believe whoever writes the script. Yesterday is reflected back by the moon. Mother's wash, the sickly smell from a dozen ruined shirts every Saturday afternoon. Wives turn their heads. There's an old grey stingray spread-eagled across the front of the chicken run. Three crows hop around it, the breeze ruffling their satin collars. They plunge their black beaks into the lukewarm flesh. Emmy Lou, your sweet, holy music drifts through the new curtains. Your song folds itself around the shack, filling the backyard, flowing through our days. Out on the back veranda, where old Dutch sits, slumped, 2 days into his latest coma. Sweet Lord, sweet poison, sweet, sweet music. That was kind of ode to alcohol and country music. They go together, of course. I'll read. This is a poem that I was reading about the sight of falcons, and I read quite in depth some ornithological sort of studies as well. And one ornithologist said that falcons have what he called four-dimensional sight. And I thought, how can I imagine what that is? How would you see in four dimensions? That they don't, also they don't think. Like, their bodies and their being responds to what's next. So when they see something coming at them or they see something they want, the thought doesn't come through their brain, dive. They just dive. So it goes directly into their whole nervous system, their whole being. It's interesting. And somehow, out of reading that, I was led back to read Spinoza again. And then I remembered that he was a lens grinder. He started off by grinding lenses. And the more I read, the more I realized I had more in common with him than St. Augustine. I came to really love him. So I wrote this poem. It's written in short lines like Zhukovsky's lines. Not that I'm claiming that this is like a Zhukovsky poem, but I used him as a guide to keep the poem tight. It's got those short lines. Although he's a great influence on me, Zhukovsky, because of mainly I get discipline from. If I get a bit sloppy, I look at him and think, got to start again. Spinoza. Oh, my soul's friend, just once, take some advice. Reach back to myths of flight. Measure a peregrine falcon's primary feathers. Check semi-plumes for bird mites. Then hold your bearings. The law could break by daylight. You can't afford this luxury. After inventing your new lucidity, tonight open Ezekiel's gates. Travel by light, shooting through veins and gelatinous floating lenses, the packed neurons composing the optic nerves of a peregrine's four-dimensional sight. Sort of pantheism, I guess. Some kind of. Okay, I'll get back to those ones looking, thinking about why I was put off religion when I was born into a family. My father's family were Catholics, Irish Catholics, and my mother's family were Scottish Presbyterians. So of course I was brought up a Scottish Presbyterian because my mother was very strong. And so I would go to the kirk as a kid. So this is called The Divine Dark, a poem without birds. And there's a quote from Emily Dickinson, "My worthiness is all my doubt." This morning the tree ferns woke and opened out as sunlight dispersed a thick mist. Morning in a memory incised with old phrases, mouthing words, then uttering a sentence with an unfinished breath. Banana trees rustle. The first breeze arrives, bringing the perfumes of the ebb. Watermarks down on the mudflats begin to disappear. Morning turns its back on the sun. Gradually, night arrives. In the skylight, stars appear through the smoke screen of a burn-off. Brilliant pinholes. Stars are clustered trees hung in the night sky. Whose body, whose eyes look up into the heavens? The problem of suffering expands forever. Dust and light again, maybe time, if it exists. On the table, a cicada flecked with flour, opening its dry cellophane wings. The cat flies across polished space, illuminated by the kitchen's energy-saving light bulb, a Philips genie. Life, like a dirty wind blowing straight through a snowy head, cat's eyes, tint of fur, are rustling. Praise life with broken words. I'm thinking of Hart Crane. So it was I entered the broken world, search for love. The visionary company of love. This is the second part. Preliminary sketch, another quote from Emily Dickinson. What I see not, I better see. What I see not, I better see. What I can't see, I can really see. An old shack by the river, deserted for years now, haunted by mesh nets and anchor rope. Wild apple trees grow out the back. A charcoal sketch of this scene unfurls before me on a sheet of mist. I push aside tough vines of morning glory, then walk on into the drawing. It's difficult to move in this landscape. I have forgotten the names of most flora and fauna. Cross-hatched charcoal enfolds me, and I become a part of the subject matter. My shape drawn carefully, sharp and figurative. However, precision no longer interests me. My attention is focused by smudges, the forms grown vague. Just 50 years ago, a country of sandstone and gums, a second ago, ferns and hardship. The heavy tidal swings roll corks and drown fish caught by their gills in the smothering mesh. In the distance, bushfire writes its killer lines, orange loops, burning serifs spill over the sandstone escarpments. I fished these tides when I was young and abstract. What rubbed off? What ideas sunk home? I rejected the lessons and feared my mother's God, the Christ I couldn't believe in. The friends in those days, the ones I loved, are now drawn beside me in the margins. The kirk we attended appears, the place where the minister refused to tell me exactly what a soul might be, although mine, come judgment day, would be flung into hell along with the others who weren't chosen. The Presbyterian soul is not mysterious. It's something we were lumped with. Now I rise from the sketch, my face smeared with ink from years of sinning. Back on the river, my boat ploughs through the fog. I'm looking hard. What form, shape, or song might represent a soul? What words, paint, or mud resemble such an intangible glow? A stain of mist hangs above a black butt, brushed by the winds of a grey-headed flying fox. We'll get back to that again. And I'll skip to this one. This is a poem I wrote. There was this wonderful show of Cezanne's painting, one of my favorite painters, I was in some strange state when this happened. I mentioned it to my wife, Juno, that, oh, the Cezanne's having this wonderful exhibition. It's coming to Australia for one time only. We must see it. And she booked the tickets in the Art Gallery of New South Wales. About 2 months went by, and it came up, and Juno was dressed, and she came in. I was in my study, kind of in the gloom, writing on the white abyss, reading Mallarmé or something, and she said, we're going. I said, where are we going? She said, to the Cezanne exhibition. I said, oh, God, I can't go to that. And she said, why? I said, I'm writing poetry, I can't go. And she said, all right, and she went off. And about half an hour later, I said, what am I doing? what does that mean? And so I wrote this poem on not seeing Paul Cezanne. I think of the waste, the long years of not believing the tongue, pretending in the midst of words to speak, to keep walking that bend in the road. I cursed myself for not having spoken. The blank sheets of air could have added words smudged out and revised with a colour, stroked instead of butting, coming to the shape by layers, stumbling in from the corners and rubbing out the hard light. The countless fish flapping on boards, have they just disappeared? There's no way back to the water to catch again that possible colour. Outside the window, in the black night, mosquitoes gather under the floodlights on the pontoon until the empty westerly blows. Everything that matters comes together, slowly, the hard way, with the immense and tiny details, all the infinite touches put down onto nothing. Each time we touch, it begins again. Love, quick brush strokes, building up the undergrowth from the air into what holds. I'll go back to my new books. I was reading a lot of Lorene Nerdecker's poetry and found, you know, lots in common with our families, being fishermen and net makers. And although she had a harder life than I did, I think that was she had to fish for carp, or a dreadful sort of fish. And they're even when you catch them, they smell like anything. And it would be hard, really hard work, making a living from catching carp. I love her poetry. It's affected me a lot. It's affected me as well as my work, I think. This is a poem about my grandfather and my father mending their fishing nets in the backyard of a house. We lived down by Sydney Harbour, near where the Sydney Opera House is. In those days, it was a working class area called Blues Point. And this is a poem about them in our backyard, mending their nets. Net makers, they stitch their lives into my days. Blues Point fishermen, with a smoke stuck to their bottom lip, bodies bent forward, inspecting a haul net's wing draped from the clothesline, their hands darting through mesh, holding bone net needles, maybe a special half needle carved from tortoiseshell, their fingers browned by clusters of freckles and tobacco tar, slippery with speed. They wove in everything they knew, along with the love they had, or had lost, or maybe not needed. During my school holidays, I watched them and came to love this craft of mending in our backyard by the harbour, surrounded by copper tubs, brimming with tanning soup brewed from bloodwood and wild apple bark. These men could cut the heart clean from a fish with a swipe of a fillet knife and fill buckets with gut flecked with the iridescent backs of flies as it fermented into liquid fertilizer. I'd water my father's beds of vegetables, rows of silver beet, a fence of butter beans. In the last of the sun, I'd watch our peacock spread its fan, the hose sprayed from water, from a water tank, house high, fed by gravity. There's a bit of Elizabeth Bishop in there too, I noticed just then. Iridescent backs of flies. It's not exactly her, but I must have remembered that. When I was younger, I got into trouble. I left school when I was, I was expelled from school, actually, when I was 13. And I had lots of birds. My father had pigeons and fowls and chooks. It's what I had in common with Robert Creeley. We could breed, we could talk about chicken breeding. And he loved, as I did, tumbler pigeons. They would fly up and come tumbling down. And we both checked out these stories and these memories. And what we loved most was how close they would get to the ground and go back up before they would break their neck. Sometimes that would happen. They would come tumbling down and it would misjudge and crunch. We didn't like that, but we liked the ones that just got away with the dive. I lived near the zoo, the Taronga Park Zoo, and I was drawing birds all the time, and I used to go to the museum and copy birds of paradise from New Guinea. I loved them, looking at their feathers and imagining them in the jungles of New Guinea. Then I heard that the Taronga Zoo had acquired a paradise rifle bird. So I went and looked at it, and it was in quarantine, which made it easier for me. So I climbed over the fence of the zoo and stole the bird of paradise. And I got caught for that, and I got a bond from the police. I broke the bond, and eventually I became what they called an uncontrollable child. And I went to a series of juvenile detention centres, boys' homes they were called in those days. It's a nicer word. and by the time I was 21, I found myself in the penitentiary. It was just sort of institutionalized, and my friends were petty crims, jockeys, and bird traders, and things like that. And I would just get caught. When I was arrested, they'd say, "Did you do it?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I did it." And I didn't ever deny it. I'd say, I'll write a confession if you let me use your typewriter. And I'd sit there for hours just typing these confessions, which I didn't know at the time were probably my first poems. And these things, as life goes on, it becomes really funny because I realised that Enid Starkey got most of her information on Arthur Rambo from the police reports as he travelled across the country. And it's him talking to the coppers. When I was 21, I was in Long Bay Penitentiary, which is the worst prison in Australia. And here's the poem. I spent my 21st in Long Bay Penitentiary. Each day in the front yards, we paced up and down. At night, I read novels and the poetry of Percy Shelley. Sometimes an education officer would turn up and ask, "What are you going to do with your future?" I'd tell him I wanted to be a poet. He would shake his head and comment that I was being insolent. After weeks, I convinced him that we wanted to start a debating team. There were plenty of crims who would join up. It took a month to convince the governor. Finally, the authorities agreed that we could form a debating society. Things went well, and we attended the library and researched our topics. Then came the day a team from the outer agreed to come inside and conduct a debate with us, the Rotarians. However, there was a condition. The governor would choose the topic. Eventually, the prison librarian ceremoniously handed us the governor's note. This was the summer of 1964. The topic was, "Is the Sydney Opera House really necessary?" It was being built at the time, and we had to argue that it wasn't necessary, and we won the debate easily. They were all sort of like Frank Sinatra, these guys. They were kind of against everything, basically. And they were really good talkers, very good. And no one could really argue with them. This next one's, I got into trouble with, I used to get into trouble, whatever I did, but I'd get into trouble within prison. And they would put a straitjacket on me and fill me up with Largactol, stop me bashing my head against the wall, which is what I felt like when I was writing poetry later on, but you don't, it's not a physical thing anymore. But I tried to commit suicide by slashing my wrists pretty badly, but I still don't know whether I really wanted to die. But I was in a solitary confinement when it happened. Here's the poem. The coriander fields of Long Bay Penitentiary. Serving 2 years hard, my thoughts, sweet as torn basil or tinged with the broken roots of coriander, soothe fragmented fear. When my mind's blank, I cultivate musky persimmons, ideas flutters. Cabbage moths, one with a lopsided wing, spins in circles. I swallow. Nothing's left of my pride. The prison doctor stitched my cut wrists without anesthetic, his idea of punishment. Laying with a blanket on the bedboard, I think of the poppy fields in the high country of Tasmania. Sun-splotched red blooms loaded with seed. Their hairy stalks raked by a wind from Antarctica. Here in my black slot, an imaginary whiff of opium mingles with the bitter aftertaste of iodine. Escape, escape. I'll read you a... This is something that happened to me. On the Hawkesbury River, we have these birds called tawny frogmouths. They're like an owl. They're halfway between an owl and a nightjar. They have whiskers coming out of their heads, and they sit so still in a tree. They look like a tree stump. They're most cryptic bird. And this is almost word for word what happened. A proper burial. It's a prose poem. The other night, outside our house, an owlet nightjar swooped down onto the road after a moth. It brought to mind an encounter last Christmas with a pair of tawny frogmouths. Driving on the highway alongside the Hawkesbury River, I noticed what seemed to be an injured bird. I pulled over and walked back to where the bird was lying and found a tawny frogmouth had been killed on the road. I picked up its limp body and carried it to the side of the highway, where I discovered another frogmouth, dead in a scattering of leaves. I looked around and there was a young Aboriginal girl standing behind me. She was wearing a white dress and seemed rather shy. I have lived here for most of my life, but I had never met or even seen her before, so I wondered where she came from. She held out a bag and said, "I will take them away for a proper burial." I asked her, "What happened here?" "All the cars kept going. Some ran over the already dead birds. You are the only one who stopped." She went on to explain the female frogmouth was the first hit. Then the male flew down to the side of its mate, trying to help somehow. Then as the girl watched, the second frogmouth was run down by a car coming the other way. The girl had walked out onto the highway and picked up one of the birds and placed it on a bed of gum leaves by the side of the road, then had gone to get a bag to carry them, which is when I turned up. We knelt on the leaves and carefully placed both frogmouths onto the used onion bag. When it was done, the girl stood up with the bag in her hand, then, without comment, walked off, heading for Moonee Moonee Point Road. I was left standing there by the paper box shaken. It had been an upsetting experience, but somehow the girl made it easier to take. I went home with the milk that I had gone out to buy in the first place. Our house was full of people, family and friends gathered for Christmas. I tried to tell my wife what happened, though it felt so out of context, a scene from another dimension. I went into my study, closed the door, and sat there going over things. Frogmouths are closer to nightjars than owls, and usually sleep by day. These two had been run down in broad daylight. The episode, though that's hardly the right word, has never left my mind. I might just finish off. How are we going? Okay. Yeah, I could read. I'll read some more. Sort of metaphysical fishing poems. This is about, we've had three or four Siamese cats. They become part of a family, and this one, Tut, Tutankhamun, shortened to Tut. One day, a reporter from the newspaper came to do a featured article on my work and me, our lives. And I said, this is Tut, so you've got to respect Tut. And the journalist went away and wrote down in the paper, in the national newspaper, Robert Adamson's cat, his name's Tootsie. T-double-O, like in a Broadway musical. And I thought, oh, God, that's dreadful. I have to... I was really upset by that. But nobody knows. Nobody cares. One of the students at where I teach at UTS at Sydney, they all say, we were here, the young people say, like I said, and like we walked down the street. And one of my students said, wow, this friend of mine took some acid and he was talking like he was talking like Shakespeare. And I said, why don't you just drop the like? And she said, what? I said, just say he was Shakespeare. She said, what a mind blower. He was Shakespeare. I said, yeah, just no, forget it, don't worry about it. And later on she wrote me a letter saying I shouldn't really criticize the way they speak because in your day you used to say man, hey man. it's interesting, I like all that. This is thinking of Eurydice at midnight. I realized, someone pointed out to me once that in all the myths of Orpheus and Eurydice, Eurydice never speaks, which at the time, this German expressionist artist, feminist artist from, I was visiting Sydney, said to me, if you write a poem about Eurydice speaking, it'll lead to others. And it did, it led to a whole book. Most of them are in that book, The Goldfinches of Baghdad. This is about the cat, though, and Eurydice. My Siamese cat has left a brown snake, its back broken on my desk. The underground throbs outside my window, the black highway of the rivers crinkled by a light westerly blowing down. I want to give praise to the coming winter, but problems of belief flare and buckle under the lumpy syntax. The unelected president's on the radio again, laying waste to the world. Faith, that old lie, I drag up impossible meanings and double divisions of love and betrayal, light and dark. Where on earth am I after all these years? A possum eats crusts on the veranda, standing up on its hind legs. My weaknesses can't be measured. My head contains thousands of images, slimy mackerel splashing about in the murk. My failures slip through my fingers, pointed at the best night of my life. This one. The cold mist falls. My head floats in a stream of thinking. Eurydice, did I fumble? Maybe I was meant to be the moon's reflection and sing darkness like the nightjar. Why wouldn't I infest this place where the sun shines on settlers and their heirs? And these heirlooms that I weave from their blonde silk. That was written quite a long time ago. I'll go back to the last time I visited America, we saw an exhibition of Joseph Cornell's tools. And I started writing about that, and it ended up being a poem about these marvelous birds we have in Australia called red-tailed black cockatoos. Joseph Cornell used these sturdy tools and instruments to create boxes, time machines, constructions made from bits and pieces, three-dimensional frames containing fans, lace, feathers, other found objects, including a torn fragment of photography, an image of Mallarmé's hands. One contains an illustration of a hummingbird. It seems to hover in the space between the glass and the backing of the box. In another, an etching of a great horned owl, like the bird I watched one night, perched on a light post in Boulder, Colorado. It swoops from memory, filling my study with flight, as I recall another visitation. This afternoon, returning from the post office, I drove ahead of an approaching storm. Trees shook and a black cockatoo flew out from them. It sailed on, just ahead of my car, for almost a minute. A long time, given the situation. Stroking the air before the windscreen. Following the road, so close I could see the details of its plumage. Two red patches across the tail feathers. Something other than beautiful. Fleeting. Maybe I'll finish up with some couple from my new book. I haven't read these poems out aloud before. Oh yeah, I forgot about these. I read this. This is, of course, I got Duncan-esque title. A poem beginning with a line from William Blake. I came across this line, or a couplet really. It says, I was in a printing house in hell, and I saw the method in which knowledge is transmitted from generation to generation. That was Blake. I thought, yeah, well, I could do that. So, on the first floor, a rainbow bee-eater was being hand-fed blue wasps by an apiarist, his head draped in alphabets of lace. On the second floor, a chef prepared chow pastry, piping unpunctuated duck liver into his chocolate eclairs. On the third floor, bookbinders were bent over tables, though instead of the usual dovetail joints, drove screws into stanzas of poetry. Whose eyes did I look through on the fourth floor? Only an owl could process the illegible scenes behind those doors of flesh. The fifth floor was a place for grinding down bones, for bone black ink pulverized from the carbonized skulls of hummingbirds. The sixth floor was a rocky paddock of spinifex grass, where an expedition of ornithologists had created a semblance of darkness for the night parrot. On the seventh level was a futuristic installation with a recorded voice repeating, the bees have never existed, forget the myth of honey. On the eighth floor was a display case exhibiting a branch of twisted amber. Embedded in its tip, the transparent imprint of a tiny wing. I looked for the word trauma in the eyes of strangers who might hold my gaze. But people growled and turned their heads away. Then the next poem is called The Ballad of the Word Trauma. The idea of massive road trauma drifts in a hospital atmosphere. A voice by the side of the bed whispers, the field opens to music. This voice holds your soul within its cage of bones, radiates affection, received by your skin's soft parachute. Then a tongue rears up to speak into the silence. Memory turns and blocks the door of sleep, draws out temper into a wire that streams names of lost relatives. Trauma can't be contained in particular shapes. It eventually becomes abstract fire, power, thought, light. At other times, it broods like a mullet outside the rank smokehouse. Trauma becomes a wall of skin and bone, a barricade of flesh, proving human arms stroking air are not wings. A brush tail's touch, fanned by a cry under the shadow of an owl-shaped drone, passing over broken strings, tangled across the lyrebird's quarter deck, where its tail's reflection on a lake is crazed by glowing twigs. Embers spit and hiss on the surface. A human rustles in the undergrowth. A marsupial moves through the dark until its cough becomes a rattle. Trauma, the infection, carried on the breath of the man who repeats his orders. At ease, attention, pull yourself together. Okay, thanks.